Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo bhagavate vasudevaya.
Om namo
Reading from Srimad Bhagavatam, Canto 2, Chapter 10. Bhagavatam is the answer to all questions. Text 24. Hastoruru hatustasya nana karma chikirshaya tayostu bhalavandra Adanam hu bayashrayam. Hasto, the hands. Ruhatu, manifested. Tasya, his. Nana. Various. Karma. Work. Chikirshaya. Being so desirous. Tayoho. Of them. To. However. Balavan. To give strength. Indraha. The demigod in heaven. Adanam. Activities of the hand. Ubaya ashrayam. Dependent on both the demigod and the hand. Translation. Thereafter, when the Supreme Person desired to perform varieties of work, the two hands and their controlling strength and Indra, the demigod in heaven, became manifested, as also the acts dependent on both the hands and the demigod. That was Krishna telling me that I often forget to say translation responsively. So that was responsive. Purport. In every item, you don't have to respond for this. Might take a long time. Actually, it's a short purport, you can if you like. In every item we can note, with profit, that the sense organs of the living entity are never independent at any stage. The Lord is known as the Lord of the senses, Rishikesha. Thus the sense organs of the living entities are manifested by the will of the Lord, and each organ is controlled by a certain type of demigod. No one, therefore, can claim any proprietorship of the senses. The living entity is controlled by the senses. The senses are controlled by the demigods. And the demigods are the servants of the Supreme Lord. That is the arrangement of the system of creation. The whole thing is controlled ultimately by the Supreme Lord. And there is no independence either of the material nature or of the living entity. The illusioned living entity who claims to be the lord of his senses is under the clutches of the external energy of the Lord. As long as a living entity continues to be puffed up by his tiny existence, he is to be understood to be under the stringent control of the external energy of the Lord. And there is no question of liberation from the clutches of illusion, Maya. However, much one may declare himself a liberated soul.
Omaginantimirandasya gyananjana shalakaya Chakshur militam yena tasmai shri gurave namaha Sri chaitanya manubhishtam stapitam yena bhutale Svayam rupa katamayam dorati svaparantikam Namasreshtam unumapi sachiputra matraso rupam rupam tasyagraram urupurim maturingostavritim Radha kundagirivaram horadikamaravasam praptoya sapatita kripaya Sri Gurum Tam Natosmi. Hasto Ruhu Hatustasya Nana Karma Chikirshaya Tayostu Balavan Indra Adanam Ubayashrayam. Thereafter, when the Supreme Person desired to perform varieties of work, the two hands of their controlling and their controlling strength and Indra, the demigod in heaven, became manifested as also the axe dependent on both the hands and the demigod. One of the lessons that this section of Srimad Bhagavatam is attempting to teach us is that we're not the supreme controller. In fact, that's one of the underlying themes of the whole Srimad Bhagavatam, of the 18,000 shlokas in Bhagavatam, that we're not the controller, that we're servants. Svabhritya vritya paricharati vritya vritya. King Kulashekar in his Mukunda Mala Stotra, he prays that the perfection of his janma, of his birth, much janmana, of my birth, Palamidam Madukaita Bhare, the perfection of my birth will be when you consider me to be the servant of 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 the servant. Seven times he says. If you consider me to be the servant of the servant, my life will be perfect. That will be the perfection, because I'll understand that I'm not the controller. The servant is dependent. It's the same mood that Prahlad Maharaj approaches Lord Narasimhadev. That he's a servant. We only have one relationship, and I'm the servant and you're the boss, you're the master. Ekale Ishvara Krishna. Arasaba Britya. There's one Ishvara, Supreme Ishvara, and it's God, it's Krishna. And there's many, 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 many sub-gods. But they're all called servants. The demigods are called servants. They're servants of the Supreme Lord. And sometimes as servants, we become bewildered, we become confused, we become covered over. Prabhupada uses this very, very poetic language in describing the conditioned nature of the jiva who thinks he's God. He says, as long as the living entity continues to be puffed up, that's one of Prabhupada's favorite terms, puffed up, like a toad, like a frog. So long as you continue to be puffed up by his tiny existence, he is to be understood to be under the stringent control of the external energy of the Lord. Stringent control of the external energy of the Lord. And there is no question of liberation from the clutches of illusion, maya. However much he may declare himself to be a liberated soul. That's the Prabhupada's concluding punchline to his purport. That we're not the controller, that we're controlled. And in order to get free from the clutches of illusion, the material energy has a strong hold on the jiva, on all the conditioned souls, can convincing us that we made the right choice, convincing us that just soon, not too far away, we'll achieve our desired goal, we'll become happy, we'll become satisfied with everything that we possess and control. The two bewildering aspects of conditioned nature is the desire to lord it over the material energy is one of them. And the other one
is to increase that propensity to Lord of the material energy. That's what Prabhupada says in the 15th chapter of the Gita. That this is the shortcoming, or this is the weakness of heart. It's called Hridaya Dobhalyam. The weakness of heart of the conditioned soul is his tendency to be Ishvara, to be Lord, and not to understand our dependent nature. And when we understand our dependent nature, we become relieved of the suffering, we become relieved of the anxiety, we become relieved of the competition, the competitiveness of wanting to be God, of wanting to be the Supreme, because there's a lot of other people that think they're Supreme in the universe. And that competition expresses itself in many varieties of unsavory exchanges between living entities as a result of anger, resulting in anger, as a result of envy, as a result of lust, as a result of greed for power and for position. We have so many unnecessary, Bhagavatam says, these are unnecessary disturbances that are caused by lack of attention to detail, by lack of attention to our real identity, our identity as a jiva, as a spirit soul. And that spirit soul as an identity has a relationship. We all have relationship, we all have connectedness. One of the prominent sociological theories in the 70s and 80s was written by a couple, husband and wife team, and they came up with this concept of the homeless mind, that the living entities in the material world, they didn't use exactly this language, but they were homeless. That they didn't have connectedness, that relationships were broken, and because relationships are broken, the individuals in society were dysfunctional, or becoming dysfunctional, because of a lack of connectedness. They developed many very flowery terms for this concept, but they captured it in the title of their thesis, The Homeless Mind. So we're wandering around here, and in order to compensate for that disconnectedness, for the homeless mind, we develop institutions and all sorts of organizations and all sorts of associations to try to compensate for that homelessness. So in modern terms, we have developed social services. The government, many countries, has a big social services department. And we have, traditionally, we had churches, temples and places where people would come together and cultivate their identity in the association of like-minded people. And this was recognized by sociologists as a healthy condition, a healthy position, a healthy system of organizing society. But then when the churches and the mosques and the temples become less important in the lives of contemporary people, they have to develop other systems. So the government takes over and develops all sorts of support systems. And the support systems and the institutions that are developed in a secular society they struggle to fully compensate for that real connectedness, the real relationship, because it's mundane. It's material. It's a material substitute for the real thing. The real thing is that we're connected through our family lineage. The real thing is that we're connected through our community. The real thing is we're connected through parampara. We're connected through the spiritual lineage. We have a connectedness with that. We understand our identity as a spirit being, spiritual being, and as a spirit soul. We have responsibility. As a spirit soul, we have a duty to perform. And the word duty is considered to be, in contemporary circles, it's not a very popular term. It's not a very popular concept, dutifulness. One time I went to a symposium on values education in Wellington, in New Zealand. And many big speakers spoke on the importance of including values in the curriculum. In the New Zealand curriculum, we should have values. And they were espousing various types of values we should have. And how we could do that, how we could include that and integrate that into the curriculum. But nobody will speak, there's some values they will never speak of. And two values for the whole day, for 8 hours of hot air. You didn't hear once the term obedience and once the term duty. And I asked, I took a flight back to Auckland with one of the presenters, and I asked her, what about this value of duty? Is that a value? Is that a valid value to teach children to be dutiful? And she said she was representing a curriculum that was written by the Brajakumaris. They're quite a successful organization in some ways because they received the large amounts of funding from UNESCO or some other international bodies to develop this curriculum, a global values curriculum called the Living Values Curriculum. And she said, no, we wouldn't speak of duty. And she said, this is like, duty is, we talk about it in terms of responsibility. Responsibility is a big value. So we talk about duty in terms of responsibility. And responsibility oftentimes, in terms of values education, in terms of contemporary theory, is contractual. It's like you have a responsibility to do this because you signed the contract and therefore you have to deliver the goods. You said you would give X, Y, and Z, so you have to. You have a responsibility. So responsibility is again it's again handed over to like a legal system or some form of control that is not in terms of voluntary or it's not in terms of our nature, but it's in terms of responsibility to the state or to the organization or to the institution. That is not in terms of, it's not a personal responsibility that I have that is cultivated intrinsically. It's not an intrinsic responsibility, it's something that's being imposed upon me by the organizations, by external responsibility. But duty, we can see, has a deeper level of responsibility. Responsibility is important, for sure. Things wouldn't happen if the policemen weren't responsible to do their job, we wouldn't have law and order. In the 1920s, there was a police strike in Melbourne. Some of you might have heard about this in your history studies of Australia. They had a police strike, and I think it was 1920. There was very difficult times financially, globally, but in Australia also. And the police went on strike. Unions are quite strong. They've been strong in Australian history for 150 years. So the police had a union and they went out on strike. And there was no law and order in the streets. So the hoodlums hit town. They went downtown and they had their pickaxes and things and rocks and stones, and they smashed into all the windows in Bourke Street and Collins Street, and they were pilfering. So they emptied out Myers, and David Jones wasn't there, but they emptied out all the stores that were there and had a good time. It was like a bargain basement sale. You know, Boxing Day in downtown in Melbourne, they opened the doors. People queue up for this Boxing Day. They open the doors on the 26th of December, and they have a big sale. All the things they couldn't sell before Christmas Day, everybody is waiting to get the half price or whatever. So if you're ever downtown on the 26th of December, you see millions of people heading for the basement of Myers because that's where they're buying all the goods. The other day in Swanston Street, we saw these people sitting outside this shoe shop. You know, I told you there was a lot of shoe shops in Swanston Street. It's true. A lot. So there's a whole row of people sitting there on chairs, and they had like sleeping bags, and it was 2 o'clock in the afternoon. sleeping bags and playing cards and all the iPads out and all the different things happening there. Mostly Asian people with all sorts of fancy haircuts and stuff. And so I said to them, what are you doing here? You're sitting on the street in like Swanson Street in the middle of the day and you got sleeping bags and everything. And said, oh, we're queuing up to get some shoes. We're in line to get the shoes. And I said, but you don't have to line up to get shoes. You just walk in the shop and get the shoes. He said, no, the shoe's going to be released on Friday. Special release of a shoe, right? And I said, really? On Friday? How long have you been queuing up? We've been queuing up for 1 week. They sleep in the city for 1 week to buy a pair of shoes. And I said, wow, these must be special shoes, huh? These must be the ones I need to get. Because I'm thinking, what shoes can I get? My mother says, you must be cold in those sandals. I said, well, I don't go to cold places very often, so it's only a couple of weeks. So I think I should get some shoes. Maybe I should get these shoes. I said, how much are these shoes? They said, they're on sale. The first day when you get the opening special, you get the best price. That's why we're queuing up. And they're the best shoes. And I said, how much? And he says something like $450 or something. I said, means there were $900 shoes? Half price shoes? And I said, wow, these Melbourne people are rich. Huh? And anyway, it turned out they were $450, so they're down to $200, so it's goodbye. If you want to get good, well, they're probably back up now. You missed out. But you could spend 1 week lining up for the shoes in Swanson Street. And I said, what kind of shoes? Come on, they must be like dance shoes or something, some fancy shoes. He said, they're basketball shoes. Right? Then I said, oh, you guys play basketball? They're like little fat Asian guys. You know? And they said, no, we don't play basketball. I said, why are you queue for 1 week to pay $250 for basketball shoes? You don't play basketball. I said, because they look nice. They look cool. Okay. So the unlimited desire of living entities who think they're controllers, who think that they can enjoy by eking out some, by increasing their capacity for sense gratification to compete with other people uselessly, to compete uselessly with other people for useless position, for useless items, for useless endeavor, is the stringent control of material energy, Maya. That means that these living entities are completely under the clutches, Prabhupada says, clutches of illusion. Otherwise, why would you do that? Why would you perform that tapasya? Imagine how cold it is. This was the coldest week, probably in winter. I was staying out in the coldest week. Like last night, was freezing. Right? Thought the whole place was going to blow away. But they do this tapasya because they're under the clutches of the illusion of material energy. Otherwise, it's useless to do that. We went to one time in Mumbai, we went to this technology expo. Because somebody, a friend of mine, was running that. And he said, you come and see my store, see my display, the technology expo. So I went to see his display. And it was all the latest technology you can think of, you know, robotics and everything like this. So there was this, the main entrance, they had a big robot there. And he was like moving like a transformer, like on this, you know, multi-dimensional. He would contract and he would expand himself and lift up his arms. And he was making something. And he was doing it really fast. And it was super like, wow, this is technology at its best, you know. He was making some kind of things. He was assembling something that a human being couldn't do. He was assembling very fast, heavy things. He was lifting heavy things and assembling them, putting them in their place. But his hands, he would clutch with his hands, his robotic hands, he would clutch these heavy metal things and then place them together and then screw them tight and then put them on the side. Very fast, things like this. So when you get with that robot, he catches you with his hands. You can't get out of his grip. Just like when Maya catches us, we can't get out of her grip. We have to go where she puts us. And she'll assemble us with all the other illusion jivas, with all the other illusion souls. We'll be assembled on the... We'll be placed on the assembly line of the factory floor. And we'll come out like everybody else. All the other illusioned conditioned souls who think that they're enjoying, but they're not enjoying. Here the demigods are given this position. Or today, Indra's given this position. Lord Indra has this position of taking charge of the hands. Balavan, Indra. He's giving strength to both of these, to both the hands. Hasto. And in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's said in the pastime of Manigriva Nadakuvera, when they're liberated from their conditioned state of being trees for so many years in the courtyard of Nanda Maharaj, when they received their liberation, they offered this prayers to Krishna, baby Krishna. And they were very grateful for having spent this time under the clutches of the material energy in this form of trees, because they got some revelation, some realization, and they got the darshan of the Lord. And there they said that let all of their senses be used for Krishna now, because this is the perfection of our senses. Let hasto chakama sumanas tabapa dayono. Let my hands and limbs be used for service to God. Let me offer God a flower. Let me offer God a garland. Let me offer God or his devotees reception with my hands. Let me use my hands to do something productive and not destructive. Let me use my hands to pray to the Lord, to offer pranam to the Lord. I can offer with my hands. Let me use my hands to chant on the bead, on the beads. So now I can use my hands to touch the tulsi beads and to meditate on the Supreme Lord. Let me use my hands to write for the Supreme Lord, to type for the Supreme Lord, to write for Krishna. Let me use my hands for cooking for the Lord. To everything, we do so many things with our hands. If I can use my hands correctly, then I can become liberated. Mukti hitva yata rupam. I can understand, Prabhupada says that liberation means to use our senses in God's service. To understand that we're a servant of God. That's a form of liberation. Let me use everything. Vane gunano katane shavano katayam. Let's speak about God. Let's speak about Krishna and his lila and his pastimes and his activities. And let's hear about them too. Let us have those big cow-like ears to capture, to cup the nectar of the transcendental sound vibration of Krishna katha. Otherwise we hear so much other katha. It's unlimited what we hear. What is available to hear is unlimited. But let us direct our hearing capacity and propensity, tendency, to hear about God, to hear about Krishna, to hear about Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, to hear about his associates, his devotees, and to become enlivened by hearing about them, to become convinced about hearing about them. Actually, when we hear about Krishna, we become more and more convinced. And we have to become convinced. We can't be on the fence. when we hear, Bhaktivinoda Thakur says, when it's through conviction that the devotees are able to crush anattas. And we only become convinced by understanding something thoroughly, inside out and back to front. And we understand something thoroughly when we discuss, when we contemplate, when we reflect. It's said that nobody ever learned anything from experience. They say experience is the best teacher. But we say, no, you don't learn anything from experience, really. Unless you reflect upon your experience, then experience, everybody has experience. So many experiences. But not everybody is becoming realized or understanding or clear. But when we reflect and when we contemplate and when we introspect and when we discuss, we become clear. It's clarification. And we should discuss these things. And we should discuss them threadbare. And we should understand that we don't know everything. And Bhakta Prabhu was saying yesterday, was it? The day before? On Saturday. That the first quality of a purified soul is amanitvam, is humility. And humility is something that enables us to access the mercy of Krishna, to access the mercy of the parampara. Because if we approach with pride and arrogance our seniors or Krishna, and we demand and we expect the mercy, we demand and expect the answer, the right answer, and right now, we won't get that. We'll be disappointed. And we shouldn't think that we know more also than everyone else in the organization or everyone else in the society. In fact, a very interesting study has been done over the last few years by a group of academics who are in the field of business management. And they're big timers from the Harvard School of Business, so they must be big. And they write these summaries of their findings. And one of the most interesting ones of late, and somebody sent me a link to this recently, it was a study done by this group. They studied a large amount of researchers, studied the Fortune 500 companies. These are the top companies in the world that outperform every other company decade after decade, like IBM and HP and some airline in America, United Airlines or something. So they have about 15 of the top of the Fortune 500 companies. And they try to work out what makes these companies, Microsoft, what makes these companies outperform their competitors every year, every decade. They're looking at trends over decades now. What makes them do this? So they're looking at leadership in the organizations and they're studying them. How is it that these leaders are so successful, these big CEOs? What have they got that other people haven't got? So they analyze their personalities and their characteristics and their responses and their manner, their demeanor, their exchanges. They analyze everything. They interview them, they observe them, they interview the people in the organization. It's fully, right? So there's completely, did this study. And they came up with this, and Jim Collins is the main person involved here. He was making a presentation to his conclusion, his findings, to a very large audience, like equivalent to a very sophisticated TED talk for businessmen. And he had everybody's attention. Everybody, the top leaders in the society and business world, are listening to the conclusion, to the findings of what makes the best organizations tick. And what is it about their leaders? And so they were listening. What is it? Is it his charisma? Is it his knowledge of the product? Is it his way he interacts with people? Is it his technology that he's got around him, his access? All the variables they studied. And they analyze them. You know how they can analyze things. So they studied them all. And then he said, actually, the single most determining feature or factor in underlying all of the top 15 Fortune 500 company leaders was the quality of humility. The leader was humble. And everybody was saying, no, how can it be? These guys are humble. They're like the biggest entrepreneurs in the world. And he said, yes, they were. And he explained what that humility means and how that humility was supporting and facilitating the success, their success, personal success, and the success of the organization. And he said that one thing is that these people do, the organization is bigger than them. They understand that the organization, that they're just an instrument to the success of the organization. And then he said, when something goes wrong in the organization, he says that they're like mirrors and windows. When something goes wrong in the organization, they look in and they take responsibility. And they say, I messed up. I shouldn't have put that person here. I shouldn't have done this. We should have done this. We should have. So they take part or responsibility for what went wrong in the organization. That's the first thing. Humility. Not pass the buck. Generally, when something goes wrong, we look straight away, we look for someone else who did something wrong. It wasn't me. I didn't do it. I noticed that. In my own self, I noticed that. I'm sure you have that same quality. If someone's going to chastise you, or you're put on the spot, then you think, it wasn't me. I'm thinking a million things that I could do to get out of this, to shift the blame. So they take responsibility. The second thing is, when the organization is thriving and succeeding, then they open the window and they look out at all the other people in the organization that are responsible, that are part of this success of the organization, and they give credit to everybody. So they don't puff themselves up and say, yes, the success is because I put the right people in the right place and they got inspiration from me and I'm such a fantastic leader. But the success was because these individuals worked hard. And that was what they found. Humility was the single most determining factor and success factor in all the top Fortune 500 companies. So this is today's lesson. It's a lesson in each of these days, that we don't have any strength to use our hands if it was not for Lord Indra. And here Prabhupada gives a hierarchy of the order coming from Krishna. The living entity is controlled by the senses. The senses are controlled by the demigods. The demigods are the servants of the Supreme Lord. That is the arrangement of the system of creation. So we're, as conditioned souls, we're controlled by the senses. And to become free from the control of the senses, we have to act in cooperation with the demigods, in the Gita says. Be thou happy by cooperation. Okay, there's a major walkout going on here. It's time to wrap it up. It's not my fault. Not my fault. I was asked to give class at the last minute. Who can I blame? Nanda Mandir. We should go on for another 20 minutes now, right? Keep everybody here. Suffer with me. We'll suffer together. Any questions or comments? Yes.
How do we define humility?
Humility means to understand that we are small and Krishna is great, Krishna is big. And humility doesn't mean that we deny ourselves, we deny our existence, we deny our talents or abilities or our skills. That's not humility. That's false humility. That's counterproductive to bhakti. That's not humility. Humility means, Prabhupada says, not to be anxious to be recognized by others. In Nectar Devotion, he says. Sorry? Bhagavad Gita also. Not to be anxious that I should be recognized. In one place, Sanatana Goswami says, about humility that it's recognizing our capacity for service to Krishna and engaging our propensity and our God-given talents in Krishna's service. That's humility. Not in my service, but in the service of God. Hasto chakamasu manastava padayona. To use our hands and limbs for Krishna. That's humility. When we use our senses, our words and our speech and our hearing and our hands and our mind and our legs for God, for Krishna, we become humble. It's the bow down mister. You might not have heard that song. It was a few years ago. One of the pop songs a few years ago was by a guy called Boy George. And he met many devotees. And it was a very catchy song. It was Bow Down Mr. Hari Rama Hari Krishna. We sing Radhe Shyam. You remember that song? From, what was it? From Bangalore, from Mumbai to Bangalore. Everybody knows the score. It was good. It was about Hare Krishna. He chanted Hare Krishna the whole time. We sing Radhe Shyam. That was his thing. So, bow down. When you bow down, mister, you become humble. We become humble. Bow down to the Lord. Sing Radhe Shyam. Okay. Granta Rad Srimad Bhagavatam Kijay Shri Prabhupada Kijay Gopinandi.